In 1967, one out of two Americans didn't think that the multi-billion dollar price tag to get a man on the moon would be worth it. But President Kennedy's ambition to fulfill the mission as one of the great human challenges, not because they're easy, but because they are hard, he said, had unintended benefits for all humankind. Laptops, camera phones, and even home insulation. These are just a few of the thousands of modern inventions that are spun out from America's space mission. Listening to Professor Mariana Mazzucato, one of our leading economists, warm to the theme, you start to wonder what would happen if humanity concentrated on pressing missions today, such as the climate crisis or eliminating knife crime. What unintentional positives could spin out? I visited Mariana at her offices at University College London, where she leads a department guiding policymakers and civil servants on how similar missions should be at the heart of public policy because they best drive us forward, and how the We Society informs their thinking.
The mission was not the vaccine. The mission should be, during a global health pandemic, to vaccinate the whole world. The UK economy is growing through consumption-led growth that is fueled by private debt. So you begin with a challenge, turn it into a mission, get as many sectors as possible to innovate around it, and then redesign your tools to foster that bottom-up experimentation.
That's Mariana Mazzucato on how we can create purpose through missions. With me, Will Hutton, on The We Society. This week, I'm speaking to Professor Mariana Mazzucato, an economist of growing national and international renown, even called an economics agitator by the IMF, a grand title which matches her grand mission, rethinking how we think about capitalism, but as importantly, how we then act within it. She's a professor in the economics of innovation and public value at University College London, where she's the founding director of the Institute for Innovation and Public Purpose, where global policymakers and civil servants are taught how to discover better solutions to complex problems through a missions approach. More on that later, but not only an economics agitator, but an academic entrepreneur. She's released three highly acclaimed books and advises a range of international organisations and governments. Notably, she's chair of the World Health Organization's Council on Economics of Health for All. Mariana, thanks for joining us on the We Society podcasts. When I called you and said, would you do a turn on the We Society podcast, what was your first thought when you heard the phrase We Society? How did you hook up with that?
To be honest, I just said yes because it's you, Will. We Society is a great concept, isn't it? Because it's also about how do we create wealth in the we kind of way, collective wealth creation, but also how do we then distribute it amongst the we? And that's really what my thinking has tried to do, which is to unite the two. I actually think that progressive politicians around the world have talked too much about redistribution and not enough about wealth creation. And those who've dominated the discussion about wealth creation have tended to be not only conservative, but also quite regressive in their thinking.
And you do come out a big challenge to the way we frame the discussion about the way capitalism operates. I mean, it's where wealth comes from, how risk-taking happens, what drives innovation. You want to unpack all of it, basically, and rethink it. Is that fair?
It's a fair description in the sense that I think we need to start really with first principles. So, for example, we often hear the word the state and the market. That's just the wrong way to begin because the market is not business. The market is an outcome of how we govern all the different institutions in our economy, including public institutions, private institutions that can be governed in different ways, but also civil society type institutions. So without trade unions, we wouldn't have, you know, weekends. So how do we unpack?
Because collective bargaining led to the 40-hour week and the weekend.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. But that required trade unions themselves to be structured in a certain way, and the relationship between public, private, and, you know, civil society organizations like the trade unions operated in a certain way. So just by talking about business and the state, which, you know, many people talk about in our world of innovation, people talk about ecosystems of innovation, that kind of doesn't pay enough attention to the fact that ecosystems can be parasitic, predator-prey, mutualistic, symbiotic. So what kind of relationship do we need between these different actors that will determine the kind of economy and the kind of market we actually end up getting? But what I've been trying to do in the Institute, for example, is rethink the role of the public sector, not just as fixing market failures, but being an active market shaper and co-creator. But the next question is, what are we even trying to create? What's the end goal? And in the private sector, of course, you and others and myself included have tried to rethink the governance of the private sector away from just maximizing shares towards stakeholder value and
maximizing
stakeholder.
The share price. Exactly. Yeah.
But that itself, there's just so much talk about that, but we're not walking the talk of stakeholder capitalism. So one of the questions is, if you truly have a we society, as you talk about, what would it look like to walk the talk of stakeholder value in terms of both how we create wealth collectively, but also how we distribute it collectively? And what does it mean for the governance structures within all these different types of institutions, but also the governance of their relationships?
And so this is a big deal. Come on, this is a big deal.
You are
talking about reshaping pretty much everything. Some stuff would, I think, respond to kind of comparatively small tweaks, but a lot of it you're talking about a wholesale reshaping.
The biggest reshaping is rethinking the state.
Yeah. Is that, do you have, I mean, help the listeners. I mean, is there a kind of country or a model that you have in mind people can hang on to when they're listening to you?
Well, the reason I recently wrote this book called Mission Economy, A Moonshot Guide to Changing Capitalism, as I said, we would never have gotten to the moon, which was really hard back in the 60s and in 69, had we had the kind of governance structures we have today on the ground, in government, in business, and how they work together. So to get to the moon, we required massive government leadership. Kennedy talked about, we're going to do it because it's hard, not because it's easy. It required lots of different sectors. It wasn't just aerospace. 400,000 people worked on it. But what was interesting is the first thing that government did was change the tools on the ground. They literally designed procurement to be different from how it was being used, to be more outcomes oriented. They put into the contracts between public and private no excess profits. And they were very aware. By the way, not no profits, no excess profits.
Yeah,
in other words, let's not turn this into a gambling machine, right? But also they were very aware in NASA that they would never have been able even to know which private sector organizations to work with if they themselves were stupid. So they were aware that they were starting to outsource too much to the private sector. And the head of procurement, this guy called Ernest Brackett, said, if we continue that, we're going to get captured by brochuremanship. And I think what we have today in
That's
countries like the UK.
Brochuremanship.
Yeah, you, not PowerPoint.
You mean what? They pitch with a brochure.
Exactly.
And they say you're going to get all these wonderful things.
Yeah.
And you pay for it and you pay an excess profit. But that was all in the brochure.
Exactly. Because if you don't know what you're doing and you don't understand your landscape, what management theorists call absorptive capacity. So absorptive capacity was a concept invented by business school folks when they realized that companies like Dell computers weren't kind of really making things anymore. They were just assembling things that were already made and innovated by others. And so they said, if you have companies that stop doing their own research and development, they're just not even going to understand their landscape. They won't understand even the opportunities that are out there. So I've used that concept for the public sector. If you just outsource and use Deloitte to do your test and trace, or ask McKinsey to run your climate strategy, or ask Serco and G4S to run your prisons or, you know, the Olympic security, and so on, then you stop doing. And if you stop doing, you stop learning by doing. And if on top of that, as soon as you make a mistake,
you make the state kind of stupid.
You make the state stupid, which, by the way, a Tory conservative lord in the UK, you'll know, said this recently, Lord Agnew. He said, if we continue to outsource government capacity.
He was the minister, he was an anti-corruption minister, as I recall.
Yes. And he
resigned because he couldn't monitor the scale of the surpluses and the scale of malfeasance going on in the in public procurement over in the
COVID crisis. That the Whitehall had been infantilized.
Yeah.
Infantilized. So I actually opened the book up with that, which is, we have infantilized governments worldwide, not just Whitehall, by overly consultifying them. My next book is actually on the history of consulting. But already, you know, it kind of in this book, but also in the work that I've been doing globally and looking at examples on the ground where actually we have that capacity and how we have to learn how to build it because, you know, any company will know that they need capabilities and capacity. If you go take an MBA course, a master's in business administration, which is the courses that managers take, they're trained to think about kind of value creation in their companies. They take courses like strategic management, decision sciences, organizational behavior. They're trained to think about the problems that happen when a company becomes too big. There's a famous textbook called Rejuvenating the Mature Corporation. Instead, when a public sector institution becomes too big and inertial, we just say, oh, it's a bureaucracy. It's bureaucratic. We don't realize that we can transform our bureaucracies to be much more agile, creative, flexible, but that's impossible to do if the narrative of the public sector is at best a market fixer, an enabler of the private sector, a de-risker of the risk takers, and so, you know,
so the public sector,
a redistributor.
I get it. So the public sector can act like NASA did when it actually kind of mobilized by Kennedy, kind of organize the Apollo moonshot. That's your basic kind of.
Well,
and you can broaden that out. Yeah. You can make that same kind of approach could be applicable to a kind of how you rejuvenate universities, how you organize attack on climate change, how you could organize healthcare. I mean, is that your?
That's what. So the book says, look, if we did it to get to the moon and back, which is so much harder than delivering personal protection equipment to frontline workers, perhaps it's also that it's only when we see problems as urgent or someone frames it as a security risk. You know, at the time it was beat the Russians, but they didn't stop at beat the Russians or let's go to space before them. They made it a very clear moonshot, which was getting to the moon and back in a short amount of time. And second, they had to get lots of sectors together. It wasn't just like one sector, big project, kind of put all your eggs in one basket. And third, they were able to catalyze bottom-up innovation. So it's not about top-down micromanaging, big state telling everyone what to do, but it's a confident state setting a direction, being clear what the goal is, but then opening up the process to as many different businesses as possible and redesigning the tools. Procurement, grants, loans, bailout programs during COVID-19 recovery should be outcomes-oriented as well. And so that kind of confidence, that confidence that government had in going to the moon, we don't have today. They are constantly getting captured by brochuremanship. They also don't know how to negotiate the deals. And we've just had these massive COVID-19 recovery packages with very little conditions attached. So just subsidies, guarantees, loans. And yet we talk about Build Back Better, but don't realize how to do that at the contract level.
It was a wasted opportunity, and not much seems to have been learned. I mean, I was quite struck by a piece that Andy Haldane wrote, kind of commenting on the success of the vaccine program, how actually it had taken, you know, government smart procurement, upfront royalties on, you know, you that, the developer of the vaccine, you can get upfront royalties that we'll pay you, so you've got the funds to develop this vaccine. And the whole damn thing was a kind of exercise, and actually, in a sense, it was a mission. We've got to have a vaccine in play within 12 months.
Well, the problem is, so I'm currently, I mean, because you're absolutely feeding now my, I don't want to say anger, but disillusionment, which is the mission was not the vaccine. The mission should be, during a global health pandemic, to vaccinate the whole world. So that would require, again, a very different type of contract, a very different type of conditionality, a very different type of design of the collaboration, a very different type of intellectual property rights system. And so if the mission is vaccinate the whole world, we need to backtrack and say, what does it mean for, again, the design of the system? And that's what we're trying to do in the World Health Organization Council on the Economics of Health for All, which I chair. It's an all-woman, nine-woman panel, women economists from around the world, where we say if
was
health
it,
for
was
all
that by
is...
design or by accident it was all women?
Well, Dr. Tedros, who's the head of the World Health Organization, asked whether I'd be interested in being the chief economist for WHO, which I said I'd love to, but I have no time. I'd love to run a council. And then I looked for the best economists, and they were all women, including Vera Songwe, who's the head of the UN Economics Commission for Africa, Kate Raworth, who you might know on her work on Dunnard Economics, Jayathi Ghosh, a wonderful Indian economist. Anyway, so the problem with the vaccine is that we haven't actually then thought through how do we redesign things like intellectual property rights. You know, intellectual property rights today are way too wide. They're too strong, hard to license, and they're too upstream. So the knowledge itself, the early research, is actually privatized. That's not what we should be doing with our patent system. It's been abused for rent seeking. And also with the vaccine.
Just help people run with rent seeking, because you and I understand that.
But I mean, rent seeking is when, so if you think about it, and you know, Karl Marx, Adam Smith, David Ricardo thought a lot about this.
These are all the great political economists.
Great old political economists actually talk about the history of political economy and theories of value in my other book, The Value of Everything. But basically, there's a difference between profits, where you're kind of earning money based on perhaps something, you know, you've made and created, and rents, which are the excess profits that you're earning because you're also blocking others from, you know,
in one way or another, you've cornered the market or rigged the market. You're getting an above normal or above average.
Yeah, or if you're just a troll under the bridge charging people to cross the bridge, like much of the financial sector is, which is not actually creating anything new. It's just creating lots of fees for moving existing stuff around.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, it's not to say that all of finance does that. There's all sorts of different types of financial institutions, but there's a large part of the global financial system, which is basically just kind of financing itself, first of all, but also just charging lots of fees for moving existing assets around and making money from the changes in the prices every time those assets change hands. I would argue that a lot of that is about earning rents, not actually earning what Schumpeter would call, Schumpeterian profits from innovation. And
a great theorist of innovation, Schumpeter.
Yeah. But so with the vaccine, what's interesting is there's 6 or 8 vaccines out there. And I think one story that should be told, which I'm not sure if Andy, good friend, also tells, is that the AstraZeneca vaccine, they actually negotiated with the Oxford researchers to, you know, lighten up on the patents, to share as much of the knowledge, to keep the costs and the prices low so that they could actually be delivered and used in Africa.
It was over a billion, wasn't it? It was over a billion shots, I think. In fact, I'd lost track of it, but certainly over a billion vaccines. And that was the numbers that they were talking about 6-9 months ago.
Yeah, but also to keep the costs down and the prices low so the developing world could afford it.
So your challenge to that kind of received kind of wisdom about how successful the British vaccination program was in creating the vaccines and kind of rolling them out so quickly is, in a limited way, yes, but actually you misdefined the mission.
Globally, because this was, of course, is a global pandemic. It's a global mission. I mean, this is also interesting, you know, like getting the plastic out of the ocean. No one country is going to do it on their own.
Yeah.
We need global missions, and it definitely requires multilateral organizations, but it also requires a level of global coordination, including on, you know, from the WTO, on how we actually set up our regulatory and legal structures and trade structures for these global problems. And of course, climate change is a huge global problem that's not going to be solved by any one country on its own. But on the vaccine, what the UK did at a national level, I think, is often what it hasn't done nationally in other areas, right? So there's no clear mission for what currently, I would say, the UK health sector is trying to do in terms of then how it collaborates with the private sector. The PFI schemes, for example, which many have critiqued, we're bringing in the private sector into a public health system without actually governing that relationship to fulfill public goals.
The private financial issue I was an early critic. It was just extraordinary. It was extraordinary at the time when it was first dreamt up by Norman Lamont. He never meant it to be scaled in the way that New Labour scaled it. And it ended up with the coalition government knocking it on the head. New Labour, extraordinarily, was a champion of this.
Yeah.
And it, as you say, ungoverned, open-ended, and with, 5 or 6 times the ultimate capital cost?
I mean, exactly.
It was a ridiculous.
But we're still living through the consequences of that by these cuts that are now being made based on a system that has wasted so much money with no actual direction, without people being at the center, you know, making sure that we actually have well-being at the center of how we govern our economy.
I just want quickly to pause the conversation here to tell you a bit about the Academy of Social Sciences, the organization behind the We Society podcast. Formed in 1982, the Academy of Social Sciences is a home for academics, practitioners, and learned societies in the social sciences. Imagine a world which is more equal, more sustainable, and politically stable. Well, the social sciences are trying to achieve just that. The social sciences aren't just about theories for academics in ivory towers. Those in the field strive for concrete and positive change in society, often for the most disadvantaged. We want to solve big issues around the climate crisis, poverty, education, health inequalities. The list goes on, as the breadth of what social scientists strive to achieve is almost limitless. You can find out more about the Academy of Social Sciences' work and support us by going to the website acss.org.uk. That's acss.org.uk. And don't forget to follow the We Society on Twitter at the We Society Pod. Now, back to the conversation.
There you are, chairing this council, the global kind of perspective on health equalities. I mean, I'm imagining that you're having to kind of put together kind of theory and practice.
Yeah.
And you'll be working alongside policymakers. Give us an example of what you're doing.
So the council is structured to work over 2 years. We're now in our second year. The first year, we put together really groundbreaking, I think, what we call policy briefs. They're brief, luckily, they're not big books, around four themes. One is value. How do we value health for all? You know, why is it that we don't value care? You know, why do we call essential workers essential, but haven't actually valued the social structures within which they work? And this is, you know, a theme that feminist economists have been talking about for a long time. But part of it is also about understanding the value that literally comes out of a health innovation system as having been, again, collectively created. So how do we value all the different organizations that are critical, as you mentioned before, to make vaccines? The second pillar is on innovation for the common good. How do we actually innovate in a way that's truly collaborative and fostered by collective intelligence, which means that we need to pay attention to the design of these public-private partnerships, like the examples we gave before, where the AstraZeneca one actually, I think, was a better example. It's not perfect, than the Pfizer one, which, you know, it's not surprising. Pfizer is literally one of the most financialized companies in the world. The third theme is finance. It's not just about money. We can't just say spend a lot of money on health innovation. The structure of the finance matters. So the fact that we've had the World Bank and the IMF lend money, for example, to developing countries, but with very problematic conditionalities that reduce their fiscal capacity, actually meant that in many parts of the developing world, they weren't able to implement many of the solutions they require just because they've become so weak and hollowed out. And the fourth stream, just before I get to the implementation a bit, and I'll stop so you can ask me a question, is on public sector capacity. On public sector capacity. So value, innovation, finance, capacity. Because on the capacity bit, we did a study with UNDP, which showed that it was in countries like Kerala in India, Vietnam, Rwanda, Togo, which had actually made investments in their administrative capacity that did so much better than other developing countries. And when you don't have that, when you hollow out your government, it's not surprising you can't do test and trace, that you have massive digital divide problems, that you can't deliver the vaccines, that you don't deliver your PPE to the frontline workers. Of course, these were all problems we also had in the UK. But what we need is lessons on the ground of how to do it better. And scale up those lessons as opposed to just say it's all, you know, either all terrible or pretend it's all fine and we're prepared for the next pandemic.
Because what was happening in large parts of Africa, especially rural Africa, with lack of vaccination, was that the COVID was just sweeping through and people were, I mean, the way they got health immunity was through catching it, dying, and suffering long COVID and all the...
Begun there, we would all globally have been worse off. I mean, African health systems are much, much worse than the Chinese health system. So that should have been a lesson for us to now at least make sure that all this COVID-19 recovery money that's coming out of the advanced industrialized world would have also helped create stronger global health systems. We haven't done that. Hardly any money has gone into global health systems. So if those global health systems are weak, pandemics continue to spread and come back to bite.
That's horrible. Where is there any good example of, you know, something that is happening as a consequence of your initiative that wouldn't have happened without you? I mean, Togo? Or is there something? Is there a part of Africa? Investment taking place in a health capacity somewhere that wouldn't have otherwise taken place?
Yes. Well, so what I forgot to say is the second year, because, you know, it's very young, this council, the second year is all about implementation. So the first year was about we need new economic thinking because it's an economics council. The old economic thinking at best said, invest in health because it's good for the economy. We say, no, invest in health for all and set up your economic structures, procurement, outcomes-oriented budgeting, intellectual property rights to deliver on it. So the first year was on specific recommendations on the how. Second year is on, let's work with partners to deliver on that. So we're just beginning this. We're crowding in partners globally who might be testing out an outcomes-oriented procurement around health for all, or projects between big pharma academics and government organization that truly have these parameters, concrete parameters for collective intelligence versus rent seeking at the center of how they collaborate. But what we have done in the meantime is we've informed processes like now there's a big financial intermediary fund. It's called the FIF, F-I-F, nice acronym, which is meant to help governments globally be more prepared for the next pandemic. And the World Bank is housing this fund. It's currently $10 billion worth. But what we've said is be careful. We've seen this before. We've seen funds being set up. We've seen them nested within organizations like the World Bank, which then hand them out with very problematic conditionality. So all those examples I just gave before, including public sector capacity, if you don't have that, these funds then fall on hollowed out institutions. So the real conditions that should be tied to receiving the funds should be that you will be investing in local capacity to actually deliver on health for all goals. But if you actually look at how these funds are structured, it's almost the opposite. There are often conditionalities on lower your deficit, lower your you know, public budget.
It is one of the troubles is, isn't it, that actually the public, the officials are kind of, they're covering their ass, really. I mean, the conditionality is actually saying to whomever they're accountable, you know, yeah, we handed out these billions of dollars, but we set such tough conditions that, you know, don't blame us if it goes wrong. You know, we went in with our eyes wide open, and by doing that, they actually kill it at the very beginning. And that seems to, is that one way of understanding what you're saying?
Yeah, I mean, it comes back to the question of what would it mean to actually have a true common good approach to these goals in terms of how to actually make sure that all the different actors in the system are strong, are able to collaborate, and the design of the collaboration, whether it's for a vaccine or for, you know, it's not just about vaccines, it's also therapies, remedies, and, you know, health system kind of structures are designed in such a way that truly have kind of people's lives and their well-being at the center, which then define the structures, the tools, the instruments.
Common good and public good. That's a differentiation that you make that's a stream to your thinking. So just speak to that for a second. I mean, I'm public, you know, is of citizenship, but isn't commonality also citizenship?
Well, I use it, so I'm really addressing economists who unfortunately have huge power on what governments do. The public good in economics sounds good, because one of the two words is good, but it's actually very limiting. It's basically the state filling the gap of something the private sector is not investing in due to characteristics like positive externalities. So if you have, say, basic research and development funding, which creates all these knowledge spillovers, then you might have too little private investment in that because they can't appropriate the profits. So the idea is that the public sector fills the gap, or clean water, or defense systems. These are all seen as public goods that you have too little private investment, so the public sector fills the gap. The common good is a much stronger concept, in my view, because the public good, the idea is that there's a market failure and the government comes in to fix that. The common good means about creating and shaping a very different type of economy. It means collaborating together, not one side just fixing or filling the gap of the other. It means having a common goal and welcoming the risk-taking, the experimentation, the difficulty together, right? So that's why I was so interested in the moon landing, because Kennedy was clear, we're doing it because it's hard, not because it's easy. Whereas the public good idea has helped, has made governments think about facilitating. You are facilitating the private sector. That, you know, I'm Italian, facile means easy in Latin, right? So you shouldn't be making something easier for something else. You should be taking on difficulties together. You should be welcoming uncertainties together, and that will then define what kind of structure you need in-house. So a welcoming of experimentation within the public sector is very different from
a
different facilitating
kind,
role.
You want a different kind of civil service. You want a different kind of human being in it. You want a different framework. You want to kind of remake our world. Mariana, social scientist, academic entrepreneur, the IMF's economic agitator, wonderful. And we've done kind of health in Africa. We've done the Apollo program. We've done, we've discussed the myths of so many myths around what government is and limits of government. You've repeatedly come back to the importance of thinking about mission, from which all can flow. notably innovation. Remarkable. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Will.
It was really wonderful. Thank you, listeners, for listening to the We Society from the Academy of Social Sciences. I'm Will Hutton. And to find out more about future episodes, please subscribe to in the usual ways and leave us a review too. So to find out more about the Academy of Social Sciences, head to acss.org.uk or follow us on Twitter. Until next time, goodbye. The We Society is brought to you by the Academy of Social Sciences, acss.org.uk. I'm Will Hutton. The producer is Emily Finch, and it's a Whistledown production.